Hi everyone. So today is a solo podcast again on Keno and Yoga by me. So you have to listen to me for half an hour or so. And today the topic is on teaching. So I received so many different questions on how and when should I teach, and if I'm ready to teach, and how do I know, what should I teach, why am I losing beginner students, all these different questions I've received, you know, kind of quite regularly. So I thought today I would just note some down and then see if I can say a few intelligent things on them. You never know. You never know. We hope. We live in hope. So starting off, how do I know when I'm ready to teach? Well, I really, really thoroughly remember, like vividly remember my first teaching situation. And I was actually living in a Buddhist center. So I was living and working. I was cooking, you know. You probably know by now my story. And I kind of mainly left university, perhaps early, after wanting to be an academic. And I just got thoroughly disillusioned with it. And so I started on yoga practice. And I thought an honest trade would be cooking. So I kind of semi-taught myself. And then I worked in restaurants, and I worked up from really, you know, pot wash, dishwashing to preparing the starters, you know, kind of what you call a commis chef, to chef de partie, and so, you know, to leading kitchens, right? But I kind of got fed up with that. And one of the main reasons is I was a staunch vegetarian at the time. I mean, I'm still more or less veg, but really at the time I was very idealistic, as you are when you get into anything, really. Well, usually, you know, that's what happens, right? Yoga or vegetarian or food or whatever, you know. So I was working in these restaurants, and it was very hard to get a vegetarian restaurant. And the vegetarian restaurants there were, it was more like the main thing was that it was vegetarian rather than the skill or the taste of the food, you know. So that was the main thing, you know. So there wasn't really anywhere to go in the cooking world at that time. There weren't really any high-end vegetarian restaurants, and the meat restaurants, I didn't want to prepare the meat because I wasn't eating it. So I felt completely hypocritical to work in meat restaurants. So anyway, so what I had ended up doing is thinking, well, I could use this skill to go and cook my way around the world, kind of thing. So I started working in Buddhist centers because I was also really interested in Buddhist meditation and this kind of thing, right? So that's what I did. And ended up in London, in a Buddhist center in London, a living one. You know, it's actually an old Irish IRA court. Well, it was. What was it originally? It was basically a small prison for IRA political prisoners until they were tried. Because of its location in London, it was one reason or another. Anyway, you don't need to know that. But it had the old prison cells. We lived in them. And then the main, I suppose what it was is a, what do you call it? Like the court itself, where the judge would have sat, right? A big open space. That was the kind of Buddhist meditation hall. And there was a living Tibetan Lama who lived there as well. So we were learning like that, and I was cooking for the retreatants. You know, there'd be festival days, and then for the people that lived there, and for the Geshe, for the Lama. A Geshe is a Lama who's done 7 years of intense, like basically a kind of Lama PhD. Anyway, so he was a very learned guy, and I learned a lot there. And I was cooking, and there's about three or four other staff members that were looking after the place, you know. And then people came in from the outside, all these different lay community that would come in for teachings, you know. Every day or so, there'd be some kind of meditation teaching in the evenings, and sometimes in the lunchtime as well. So, you know, needed staff, and my job was a cook. So I started cooking, and every day I would get up and I would do the Ashtanga practice that I knew, that I'd been taught. So I'd already been practicing a couple of years almost, but I never really considered teaching. But back in the day, I suppose the moral of this story is that you just kind of, it was an easier time because you just kind of slid into it. I didn't really try. I was just practicing, and then people, the other staff members, said, "What are you doing? What's that? And would you show me that?" So next day I said, "Look, I'm not going to show you today. I'm busy practicing. come back tomorrow, and I'll leave an extra half an hour at the starter end or whatever. I'll do my practice, and then I'll teach you for 40 minutes, right?" And so I started teaching the staff members, and we gathered a little group of about three or four of us doing it. And then someone, I suppose, asked me or said, "Well, why don't you teach like a class? So, you know, we've got people coming for meditation classes anyway. So why don't you teach the public, you know, charge them £5 or something, 5 euros, well, it wasn't euros at the time, right? It was like £5, but I'm trying to equate it to the kind of low fee that it was. It was, you know, a few euros, a few pounds. And you know, it's popular because there was no other yoga around. And this is the moral of the story. Back in around 2000, you were lucky to find a teacher. So I kind of slid into it, and, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. You know, it's different, you know, as you probably know, it's different practicing to teaching, but you just, I suppose the enthusiasm carried me, and I kind of felt like, well, it helped me so much, and all I wanted to do is share the practice and encourage and enthuse people to get into practicing themselves. So there wasn't such teaching much technique, because I didn't know any technique, basically. But I didn't know anything about the shapes. I just made the shapes, and, well, by that time we'd got the sheets, so you can kind of look at the shapes as they are ideally made, and you try and make the same shape as you can see visually. So there was no idea about how to do the postures or anything like that. It just started that way, just by sheer, as you can imagine, by sheer enthusiasm, by sheer appreciation. I kind of felt like and at this time I really felt like it was a sheer appreciation of how much the practice has helped me out of a sticky spot, let's say. I was in a tight spot. I'd come to practice with kind of like a low grade alcoholism, really, I could say. Like, you know, I was in a couple of years of drinking, you know, kind of drinking a lot of the day. You know, I mean, not heavily, but just drinking all the time. You know, I'd have a drink with lunch, and I'd have a drink with, you know, more drinks later, and partying every night. But I was at university, so it didn't matter. But I knew it was wrong. You know, so I knew that there was something that I was masking, you know, over by this kind of behavior. And I knew that I had to get into something that would allow me to not need the drink, basically. So that's how I got into yoga, really. I mean, I was kind of depressed with all this philosophy that I was studying anyway. It was too much head work. And then couple that with just basically being more or less, you know, how old are you when you go to university? You're a teenager, 19. I was 18, 19, 20. I was a teenager and dealing with all the normal stuff that you do then as well. So anyway, so I started teaching when I was, let's say, 21. And it was simply purely through serendipitous interest from friends, and then we spread out to doing an evening class, and people liked the class. So then we did a kind of Saturday, I think it was a Saturday, two classes, a beginner's one, and then a more advanced. I don't know what I was doing teaching anything other than beginners, really. But, you know, and the way you did it then, which, you know, was very, very common at the time, was it wasn't like, oh, you know, just a beginner's course or a half primary. It was like you did the whole primary series, and people just muddled through and did what they could. And to be honest, if I kind of feel like that's not a terrible way to approach it, as much as I'm quite careful with the way that I try and encourage Ashtanga, I kind of feel like if you phrase the practice in the right way, even though you're getting people to go through the whole primary series, you kind of say, well, you know, just do what you can in the middle, don't push yourself, make some modifications. If you can just, you know, for example, Bhuja Padasana, Kurmasana, if you could just sit there in a squat, or just sort of sit them out and join in again later, because the later ones have become easier again. So it's just, I think a lot of it's in the way that you frame it, and you're not kind of pushing people or rewarding them for their prowess particularly, which sets up a dynamic in the class as well. It's just like kind of like that spirit of just like, well, try and do what you can. You know, do what you can. Don't hurt yourself. Don't push yourself too hard. And build up over time, you know, just this, also this constant recognition that you're not going to achieve it in a day, that it's probably going to take some months, some years to get into it, you know. I mean, it was easier at that time, I think, because the demographic was also younger. So yeah, that did make a difference, even though we're talking about generally Western bodies that are, you know, I would still say it's generalization, but I'd say Western Caucasian body is still less flexible than an Asian body. But people were younger. I'd say my classes were 20s, 30s, and now they're probably 40s, 50s. And that makes a difference in terms of aptitude of people progressing through the series, because, you know, obviously, as you probably know, if you're as like me, over 30, over 40, I'm almost 45 now. So you'll notice that, you know, the body gets progressively stiffer as you get older, especially if you have, you know, if you come to it without having a movement background. You know, many people are coming, obviously, to practice having not done anything particular with their bodies, and then starting at 40. So I think that also changes the teaching terrain a bit and how you might present the class. So how do you know when you're ready to teach? You're never ready to teach, never. You learn to teach on the job. And as long as you know what you don't know and don't claim to know what you don't know, I think you're good. Because later, that after that, you see, then I started doing these beginners courses. I think that was inspired by John Scott, because he'd put the idea in my mind. I did John Scott's first ever teacher training. That was in Penzance. I didn't do it all. I did. I think it was like 10 weekends or something like 10 weekends. And I did two of the weekends in the end. But I went down there to live, and I started to, that was the only way I could do it. I started cooking for a restaurant daily. And then, you know, every 5 or 6 weeks, there'd be one weekend of this teacher training he would be running, you know, the whole weekend. That's the only way I could do it. Go down there, live there. And cook, and then wait for the weekend, and then try and take it off the restaurant, which was always a moot point. Well, people weren't happy about that. Maybe I'd work the nights and do the teacher training the day, whatever. So, you know, he put it in our minds at the time. What you should do when you're learning to teach is do a course, do a 10-week course, 8-10-week course of beginner's introduction. So the second time I started to teach, again, the first class, as I said, was living and working in that Buddhist center, and then just doing a couple of evening classes. The second time I actually did two courses. I launched two courses. One was upstairs in a local coffee house, and they had this space. It was called the Market Coffee House on Bishopsgate in the city of London, right? And it was a lovely old coffee house, right? Very Dickensian. And they seemed to just had this upstairs space, and they were using it for all kinds of things, I suppose. It was a wooden, completely wooden building, I remember, and the wooden floor, kind of creaky, the wooden floorboards, really old floorboards. And it was a super cheap rent he gave me. I think I paid like £50 for the 10 weeks or something like that. Silly money. Anyway, and I just did a poster. I did a poster and I put it up everywhere, as you did at the time. I think I got about 15, 20 signups. But again, it was the times, you know. I think I was lucky to get into it around 2000 when, you know, most people that had come to the class had never even done yoga. And that was the beauty of it, I think. I'm not saying, you know, you need to be younger to, and it was easy to teach younger people. It's just different. That's one difference. But the second difference was that people had never done any yoga before. So it really was like a tabula rasa, like a clean slate to teach the way you wanted to teach. And it was a lot easier to get through to people in a way, because they hadn't had all this different teaching confusing them and built up a certain practice and certain habits. It was like people that come to the class that they hadn't ever done yoga, and so you were teaching them from square one. Then maybe they'd done Tai Chi. I remember at the time Tai Chi was quite a competition to, you know, it was like, well, some people had done Tai Chi, some people had done yoga, you know. It was really like those were the two, that was the competition. Anyway, so I started off doing that beginner's course, and I kind of worked okay, you know. I don't know how I structured it now. I think I probably just did, you know, standing postures 1 week, and then a little bit of seated the next week, and standing, and no, I think first week I just did sun salutations, right, and then a bit of standing. But I think I obviously now, you know 25 years later, because this was, you know, it really was 25 years ago. It's crazy to think about. And I remember I got in trouble with this guy, because I took on the studio, and then I think it was a low rent, but I was paying per week, and I hadn't paid a couple of weeks. And he said, come on, you know, like, it's only £10 a week or something. And I thought, that's true. Anyway, you know, I was lucky to get people. And the other beginner's course that I ran, this is a funny story, because it was on, if you know London at all, if you don't, then it doesn't mean anything. Well, so it was on the Waterloo. So it was like by the river, and there was a dance studio there, I believe. And what I would do is, it was a walkway at lunchtime. People would walk along the river and stuff, you know, and with their sandwiches or getting lunch. And I got this, and I remember it to this day, I somehow nailed this plank of wood onto a stick. So it was like a kind of, how would you call it? Like a, when people go to a demonstration or something and they're holding those signs, you know. So it was like a sign to hold, the stick being like a staff. And my poster, I pasted it or nailed it or whatever onto this plinth or whatever it's, you know, right. And I was just standing there at lunchtimes, you know, holding this kind of sandwich board sign. I'm going to say I had it on either side of me like a sandwich board, but I don't think I did. I was just holding the sign. Yeah, that was what it was. And then I would just accost people. People would be walking past and they'd look at the picture. Oh, yoga, they'd say. And I'd say, oh, yeah, you know, give it a go. They'd say, what type of yoga is it? I'd say, Ashtanga. Obviously, no one had ever heard of it, ever. I'd say, like, you know, oh, it's dynamic and you look like you'd get into it, and I just kind of be selling them it, right, and sell them the course. So literally every day, every lunchtime, because I was still cooking, but I was cooking. I think I was still living at the Buddhist Center at the time. I'm not sure. And I'd go down there anyway, and stand outside the location, and people walk past. I'd have my sandwich board, and I'd be basically selling them to sign up for this course. So that's how I started. But was I ready to teach? No. I was petrified of adjusting people in things like Kermasana and the Mary Charleston. So I didn't have a clue how to get anyone into it or help them with it. So I just didn't push anyone. I think that's really been my manifesto from day one, actually. I've never been a pusher of adjusting people, because I just felt like, well, even if you kind of knew what you were doing, you never know how someone's body's going to react if you push on it, you know? So I'd never, even from day one, I'd never always been a bit kind of skeptical of the whole adjustments thing. So I never pushed anyone in the class. And to this day, I hope, I mean, you know, the problem is people don't ever tell you when they get injured from you, you know, but I hope I've never injured anyone in my class. You know? I don't think I have, because I've never actually adjusted anyone in terms of pushed them into a posture, really. So, yeah, so I just build up from there with the beginner's courses. And I didn't feel ready to teach. I felt a complete imposter. And I still do, in a way, because you can only, you know, I mean, with the best will in the world, you can only teach so much technique, and the rest is up to the individual to practice over time. So up to this day, I think the main job of the teacher is to encourage, to support, to hold the space, to hold the space for someone's own personal inquiry with it, and not stamp. I think it's easy to feel like, I've got to teach so much information. I've got to give them all, you know, otherwise why do they come? They need to know all this stuff. And it's like, well, I think it's on a kind of need to know basis. Like, first of all, you don't need to know so much stuff. You just need to be encouraged to practice and feel you're doing well. I think that's another thing that I didn't realize until I didn't add on to my teaching for quite a while. I was perhaps too specific about people getting the exact postures, rather than just, I didn't feel honest if I was just encouraging them and maybe they weren't doing the posture that well, you know. And now it's like, whenever people are moving, whatever posture they're doing, I just think it's great. You know, I just see people moving, you know, and I just think, wow, you know, that's incredible to be making an effort to practice and to be even trying any of these postures that are really dynamic. So I think I've changed my tune in seeing, especially as I get older as well, and see that the postures are all intense. All the Ashtanga postures, they're all pretty dynamic. So they, you know, a forward fold and bringing the chin towards the shins, that's, you know, that's intense, you know. That's commendable to develop that degree of mobility in the body. So yeah, I mean, the first degree of any teacher is just encourage. Second, you know, encourage in a genuine way, you know. Be genuine, be connect. Yeah, that's another thing. Be a genuine person. And I think, you know, it's easy when you're the teacher to feel like you take the role of the teacher almost too seriously. And you can hide behind that role of the teacher out of lack of confidence. Or you feel like, well, I don't know so much to teach. You know, like, what am I doing being in the front of the class teaching as a teacher, you know? And then you can hide behind the persona of a teacher, because basically you don't feel like you've got so much to teach. And, well, you know, I mean, day in, day out, there isn't so much to teach. You know, a lot of it is just holding the space for people and also just not putting your influence too much on their practice, right? Giving them space to decide how to practice themselves, right? I think that's a skill to learn as you go on, is that you don't want to be making mini clones of yourself. That's super boring. And that's how I felt that I was, you know, not necessarily through any fault of John Scott particularly, but that's how I felt when I quit his teacher program, because I just felt like he was such a charismatic teacher that we were all becoming mini clones of John Scott. And I kind of felt like I didn't want to be. The only way I felt like I could be a good teacher and be a successful teacher is if I was really radically myself. And that's what I've tried to do ever since, really. And I think I've gone through periods, especially my Mysore years, when I was a little bit hiding behind the facade of being a Mysore teacher, and the fact that I was going to Mysore and the other students that I was teaching hadn't been, so I knew the way it was done in Mysore. But you know, latterly, as you can probably see if you read my posts and get the general vibe of the way I approach Ashtanga now, I don't think there's anything particularly special about going to Mysore necessarily. I mean, if you want to do it, it's great. I enjoyed it, but I don't think you have to as an Ashtanga teacher. So I don't think that essentially, if we're riffing on that first question, because I'm not sure I'll probably get much far past this, if we're riffing on that first question of when am I ready to teach, and is it to do with authorization or going to MISA a number of times? You know, I don't believe there's anything to do with MISA at all. I think, you know, it turns out some good teachers, it turns out some terrible teachers. It's really a question of what's in you. I think, you know, I mean, nowadays especially, I think it's the territory has changed. And I think there's also a lot of stuff written on, well, there's a lot of stuff out there that wasn't there. You know, posts like me posting and many other people that are really good, I'm not saying I'm that good, posting information and ideas out there. So I think it's probably almost a duty these days, if you're trying to be as good a teacher as you can, to read different perspectives on the practice and approaching the practice. And that also means probably, I would say these days, reading a bit of yoga anatomy probably doesn't hurt either. Although, you know, there's not one way to approach things anatomically either. And then, you know, if you read the different anatomy books, they don't all agree. It's not just like there's one way for the body to move. But, you know, it's good to have as many different influences on your teaching as possible. And then, yeah, if you don't know, then you can also refer to someone else, or refer them to someone else, or ask. I mean, I think that's the other thing with with learning and developing your own teaching is, you know, I really feel these days we should have some kind of mentor or someone who is our primary teacher. Even if you go and find different influences from different people, I think it's like useful to have one primary teacher where you can say, this is the approach that resonates with me, and this is the person that I can ask when I'm not sure about something. And they might not give you a categorical answer either, but someone in your corner, someone who you feel is supporting you, I think that's really, really helpful in terms of your own moral, kind of like a moral support for yourself, you know, and also just a clear line in the sand in terms of the way that you approach the teaching. Because, you know, Ashtanga, it seems like one practice and one way of teaching, but there's many different ways of approach. So for me, that was Mark Darby, and I always mention him as much as I can, because he gave me an approach that I was really confident to teach in. And he was around to ask questions. You know, there's someone who I could, you know, whenever I wasn't sure, I could ask, ask for his opinion, which is really helpful. And I think we miss that these days in terms of teaching. Once you've done the TT, usually the teacher doesn't necessarily stick around and carry on being your mentor if you want that. And I always try and encourage that. I've never done a TT in person, but I've done some intensive things online, and I always try and encourage the people to keep in touch. And I'm really totally, totally up for helping to mentor people. And I think it's really necessary, because otherwise, as a teacher, you're quite on your own. And you're going to feel a lack of confidence, because every day in, day out, you're standing up in front of different people. And you're out there. You're out there exposed, in an exposed position. So it's kind of natural that you want someone in your corner to kind of keep asking questions and keep growing. And another thing with the teaching is you have to keep making it fresh, keep growing, keep learning, keep exploring different perspectives. Otherwise, you get stuck. I think, as I say, a rolling stone gathers no moss. I like these old English expressions, you know, by rolling stones, you know, really. So rolling stone gathers no moss. So you don't want to get stuck, and you start, you know, if you're not moving, if you're not constantly exploring, then you're stagnating. And it's a sad kind of law of entropy that we're under, right? You know, if you're not growing, then you're declining. But that's just the way it is as a teacher. If you're not constantly growing, then you're not just kind of plateauing generally, you're actually declining. So keep looking for new information. I still am today, you know, I've got into talking about anatomy books. I've gone into reading some more about anatomy. Don't necessarily bring loads of it to the teaching, because, you know, for love of money, you can talk about certain, put your this or that there or here, but, you know, if the body isn't doing it, the body isn't doing it. So, doesn't, you know, yoga anatomy doesn't answer all questions, but it can certainly give you some basic ideas in terms of, you know, how the body moves more or less efficiently, and even what you're trying to achieve in the practice, because it seems a question that's almost not answered, because it's so naive, so obvious. It's like, what actually is the function of these postures? Why do we need to do these in-depth postures that are so demanding for the body? What is the reason for them? You know, so you want to be able to say, you know, when someone's asking about a posture, what you're trying to do in the posture, and explain it in normal, clear language. And if you can't do that, which is also understandable, because, you know, there's certain postures that always elude us, and you think, oh, I don't have a clue what I'm meant to be doing here. Keep looking. Just keep experimenting so you can say something, or worst case scenario, just you simply admit you don't know. And there's nothing wrong with that as well, you know, rather than having, you know, just saying something like, oh, just because that's the way it's done in Mysore or Moorbundha. You know, I think that's those kind of things are very good answers, really. Just say, oh, yeah, currently I'm still exploring that. I'm not quite sure. I think, you know, I think a mature student will understand that. Other than that, really try and figure out what you're trying to do in each posture. And that, you know, because then only can you know how to instruct, right? Otherwise, then it's just, other than that, it's just the nuance, the pedantics of, oh, you should put your foot here and your hand there. But if many people's bodies don't do that, right, this is the thing. If many people's bodies don't actually make the idealized version of posture, i.e., you know, okay, the leg is in lotus and you're binding. Well, if people can't put the leg in the lotus and can't bind, what is the essence of the posture that you can still teach the series, but extricate the essence of the posture so you can understand the function, even if they're not actually doing the full idealized form of the posture? And that's the key. Because every posture has an essence. If it's a twist, then you're twisting one way at the top, then trying to resist it at the hips. You're trying to, the hip opener you get from a twist is resisting the twist with the hips. So if you understand that as a basic form, you know, the twist and what's going on there, it doesn't matter whether the leg's in lotus or you're binding or not, you can still get the same basic movement in the twist and modify it to suit the person. Anyway. Moving on. So another question. Let's have a look. Qualifications regarding your own proficiency. That's it. That's an interesting question, right? I think people often feel that they have to be the best person in the class to teach. So that's their qualification. They're the most adept at postures. And this is leading to people injuring themselves all the time as teachers, because they then feel that they're the reason they're in the front of the class is because they're the best. So they have to keep up a standard, have to basically compete with their students, or even sometimes, weirdly enough, hold them back. So then they're still the best, right? In order to be the teacher. But I don't subscribe to that at all. I think, you know, we're all born with different bodies, and your aptitude as a teacher depends on your interest in generally in being a teacher, your interest in sharing, your interest in supporting, your interest in encouraging. That's being a teacher generally. You don't have to be the best at your game, yeah. And in fact, often you're not. I mean, often the teacher, the practitioners that are the best are blinded by their natural ability and find it very hard to teach it. So not being the best is actually a real blessing as a teacher, because then you really have to think about how you're going to teach things rather than just naturally being able to do stuff. I found it really hard to teach backbends, for example. I really had to try, because I could just naturally do them, not necessarily correctly anatomically, but you know, I could make the shape. So yeah, anyway, so you know, I don't think you have to be the best. I think you have to know what you're doing in the primary series and have some idea of and know what you're doing, even if you can't make all the shapes of the intermediate series. I don't think you need to be. I think you should have some proficiency in having made the primary series, roughly, you know, even if you can't do lotus, you know, even if, you know, some things are still beyond your grasp, and then have an idea of the second series, some kind of version of second series that you can do, even if it's the essence of the posture, so not completing the full idealized version of two legs behind head or even one leg behind head, you know, as long as you know what you're trying to achieve in the postures, again, you're fully qualified Ashtanga teacher. You don't have to be the best. I think that's really an unfortunate mentality to take on, and I see it all across the board, that people pushing themselves to be the best practitioner as a qualification for them as a teacher, and the two things are different. Yeah, and not, as I said, often the best practitioners, and I've come across many good practitioners, and when I ask them to teach me, you know, they're doing this or that, they don't really know how to describe how to teach. So yeah, I think that the qualification for me as a teacher is care, interest, and interest in exploration in terms of looking at the postures and figuring out what would be the reason for sticking your leg here or your hand there. You know, what's the reason for it? Right? What's it trying to do for the body? Yeah, but it's nothing to do with your completing advanced series in Mysore, in my perspective. So take that out of the equation. Nevertheless, you're probably always going to feel an imposter to some form or fashion, because, well, at the end of the day, you can't teach anyone anything in a certain sense, because they have to figure it out, that only them can feel their body, and therefore only them can move their body and feel their body. And so they have to do it themselves. Yeah, you can't break people's bodies and put them back in a more fortuitous combination so they can then therefore do the leg behind the head. But I think also understanding one's limitations as a teacher, rather than them feeling like, I think if you drop drop the expectation of your capacity, then that makes you feel a lot less like an imposter, right? If you think, well, you know, there's only so much, only, you know, to be patently honest, only so much I can do, you know? I mean, people's anatomy will get in the way much earlier than your teaching ability probably will get in the way of your ability to teach them, if you see what I mean. You know? Many people's anatomy, their acetabulum, is fitted, the hip joint is fitted in such a way that the femur doesn't articulate for them ever to put the leg behind the head. So what are you going to do? Force it there? No. Talk to them about yoga anatomy? Well, that's not that relevant. Just hold the space and encourage and find something that they can do as a placeholder or something that they can do as in a substitute of that to make them feel good about the practice, you know? And that's the main thing. So sometimes too much information can confuse the issue. I mean, especially if you're over 25, the body is fairly set in its patterns. And with the best will in the world, I don't think we should be trying to break people out of their patterns. You know, we all spent a long time subconsciously, albeit, getting these patterns of tension in our body, working patterns of tension. We're all imbalanced balance. We're all imbalanced walking, trying to kind of find our balance in our imbalances. And to try and align someone or to try and break them out of a pattern you don't see functional, I think is a violence on them and the quickest way to injure them, right? I'd much rather work within people's imbalances and try and make them feel more effective and more efficient with the natural body tensions that their body has. And as I said, if you've got past your teens, then you've got these working patterns and they're deep. They're not just physical. The physical holdings are all underpinned by emotional and psychological patterns of tension as well. And they don't necessarily mean, oh, you know, I've got a tight knee, or it's about my father, or I've got a low back issue, it's about my mother, whatever, you know. I don't equate the tensions to the exact specifics, you know, but, you know, we all have tension in our life, you know, and it just manifests in the body in different ways, you know? But its roots are in the psychic, in the energetic, in the emotional body, not just in the physical. So as you start moving the bodies, you know, you have to be very respectful that you're also moving emotions there, moving psychic patterns, moving mental patterns. And should you be doing that? No, I don't think so. I think it's encouraging a safe space for people to gently, gradually experiment over time, but not abruptly trying to change people's patterns or put them in alignment. It's just purely injurious. Anyways, what other questions have we got? So the proficiency, qualifications regarding your own proficiency. Forget that, you know. I mean, obviously you need to have been practicing for a couple few years at least, I'd say, maybe a couple of years now. Although I started teaching before that. I started teaching probably less than a year of practice. But there were the days when there were no teachers around, so maybe I'm justified that I was just doing a service then when there were no teachers around. I suppose that one thing where there's so many teachers now is that I think it raises the bar probably because, you know, in the law of competition, you've got to be a good teacher to survive these days. It's not just a teacher of Ashtanga. You know, back in the day when you just found a teacher, that was it. You've got to be a good teacher. So in some respects, this having so many teachers out there now pushes the bar up and makes us all try harder and be better teachers just to compete in the marketplace for students, as it were. But if there's students sticking with you, if people are sticking with you, then trust that they like you and trust that you're doing a good job and that you resonate with them. You might not be the most anatomically proficient teacher in the world or the best practitioner of the world, but there's something in your personality, in the way that you are, and this is the main thing, really, that what you can't ever quantify or can't try and be. If you just are you and try and be honest and connect with people on the level, in kindness and care, then they'll resonate with them. And if you resonate with them and they feel inspired by you and encouraged and supported by you, that's the main thing. And these things aren't really... I'm not sure they're ever kind of teachable to teachers or quantifiable. They just come from just an honest care about the student. And I think the trouble with the many teachers, they're almost, unfortunately, I'd say more, and I was, so I recognize the tendency, more kind of involved at certain points in their early teaching years with being the teacher rather than just simply who's and preserving the method, you know, teaching the method, rather than just teaching kindly who's in front of them and having interest in the person, so into before the method, teaching the method, or being the teacher. Just having a kind, honest, practical care about the person in front of them is the most important thing. And I think we can be blinded to that simple factor by trying to be overly efficient in our job as a teacher. I've got so many other questions, but I think we've gone on long enough. I probably just answer one more now. What about burnout as a teacher? Someone said, what about burning out? Well, I think, you know, that's the thing, is that when you're in that capacity of burnout, you don't realize you are. And I've been in it twice. And it's really hard. And you have to listen to it, because the people will say to you around you, they will say things. And then, well, I can get defensive at that point and say, I'm fine. I've got, you know, I can carry on teaching. I'm not tired. I'm, you know, they say, are you all right? Are you tired? You seem tired. Just listen to them, I think. Listen to them and try if you can. To get away, have a break, or go and get some teaching somewhere, or have a short break if you can afford it. The trouble is, if you can't afford to take a break at all financially, that makes it tough. But you have to try and take some time off now and again to refresh yourself and look after yourself. Because burnout for the teacher is real, even though you might not be working 10-hour shifts a day. You're giving a lot of energy to people day in, day out. And it really can impact you. So you have to take that, be aware of that and the fact that you can burn out, and leave time for yourself and time for your own practice and learning more and going away and changing scene. Yeah. And then you can come back refreshed, right? There may be something in the class that that's not resonating with you. Maybe a certain dynamic, or maybe it's the center, you know, sometimes you can't see the wood from the trees, as it were. And if you take a break, you can see, it's the center. I need to change. I need to work at different centers, or I need to not do that evening class, because then the next morning I've got an early Mysore, and that's just really doing me in every week to have that morning evening combination. That's just depressing me. You know, you can look at the thing that's maybe draining your energy as well. Or maybe that center, you just don't vibe with it. The people that are coming, they're just not really your kind of students. You don't feel you're connected there. You don't feel supported by the management. Whatever, you know, there might be, you have your reasons, and whatever the reasons are, they're valid because you feel them. So, yeah, good to have a bit of perspective sometime and just recognize that burnout happens to the best of us. So it probably happened to you some point. So watch out. And just, if people are saying, you're looking a bit tired or whatever, just take it and try and take on board what they're saying, that they care for you and they're not just pointing out or criticizing you, as I would always take it. You know, you need time for yourself as well. And then finally, I'd say, you know, we have this question so often, you know, why am I losing students in the Mysore? The most obvious thing is, you've not got leader classes, you've not got led classes. Most people don't get straight into a Mysore class. So just having Mysore classes alone is too much. And you might be also teaching too rigidly. You might have too high a benchmark for students. And just not being a bit more practical, a bit more loose with the method, adapt it to people. Just first and foremost, thinking that they're not Mysore students, most of the people you'll come across in your teaching years. They're normal people. I mean, we're all normal people, obviously, but they're not. They're people with jobs and families and other commitments and other interests. They might do it 2-3 times a week. And just recognize that and teach them accordingly to that, right? And that helps a lot, because then your expectations of them and their commitment aren't too high, so you're not disappointed. And also you're teaching them the method according to their level of commitment as well. So that really helps. And then also, yeah, as I was saying, don't expect people like, you know, just people off the street to come and do self-practice straight away. You need leader classes, feeder classes, led classes. And then over time, once they get into it and they get into the knowing the flow a bit and knowing the sequence a bit, then you can start to talk to certain individuals that you can see there regularly. Okay, why don't you come to a Mysore? You know, you'll enjoy that. You're at the point now when you know the sequence a bit, and I'll help you if you don't know any buses. You just sell them the Mysore then, but don't expect them to come straight into Mysore. I think that's one of the biggest biggest problems. And then people being taught in a way that they're being stopped too early on, right? They can't do a lotus stop there, you know, they can't do a backbend stop there, you know, rather than just thinking, well, you know, you've got the two series, make, you know, as soon as you possibly can for people, make the two series, the first series and the intermediate series, applicable and relatable to people. And there's nothing inauthentic or untraditional about doing so. You're just making the practice accessible, right? The early students that came to Mysore, remember, you know, Nancy Gilgoff, she was suffering bad health. So she was held in all the second series postures. They took the hard ones out and gradually added them back in. You know, Pratapi Joyce hadn't, you know, he wasn't rigid in the way that he taught. So I think this kind of exactitude or rigidity or over litigiousness that's crept into the Ashtanga method and teaching is a newer thing. It's not helpful for you as a teacher or for your teaching, for your students either. So that's answered a few questions, and I think I've gone on long enough today. I hope I haven't bored you too much. And if you've got any comments or questions or further reflections on what I've said, please let me know. And as always, subscribe to the podcast. That always helps me, and it helps our whatever you call it, algorithms or anything like that. And let me know if you've got any topics of interest that you want me to talk about. And I'll see if I can say anything sensible. I'm no oracle, but you know, I've done it for a while, so I hope I've got something to say. Anyway, thanks for listening if you listen to the end. And I'll be back next week with a real guest. A proper podcast. I'll speak to you soon. Bye now.